Hey, my friends, welcome back to FASD Family Life, the show for families raising children and youth with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. I'm all coffeeed up and ready to go. I hope you are too. This is season 4, episode 10 of the podcast. Wow. I'm so happy you're here. I am your host, Robbie Seal. I'm an FASD educator, advocate, and the mom of 5 incredible people, including 3 teens diagnosed with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. Did you know that this podcast is supported by listeners like you? If you like the show, please go into the show notes and click support the show where you can donate and support the work I'm doing. I would really appreciate that. This week, we are back with my friend, Dr. Jared Brown, to continue our brand new series, FASD Threats to Emotional Health. Today, Jared will teach us about the fascinating topic of microbiota gut-brain axis. Relatively new literature, but it's groundbreaking and transformative. And as I'm chasing this information, it's becoming transformative in my life. I'm sure it will be in yours as well. My friends, you will want to grab your notebook and your favorite pen for this informative episode with Dr. Jared Brown. Jared Brown is a professor, trainer, researcher, and consultant with multiple years of experience teaching at collegiate levels. Jared is also the founder and CEO of the American Institute for the Advancement of Forensic Studies and the editor-in-chief of Forensic Scholars Today. And there's a link in the show notes if you want to learn more about him. Before we dive in, be sure to join me for the next episode of the FASD Family Life podcast when I tell you about a fascinating research study looking into the impact of prenatal alcohol exposure on microbiota and gut health, and how you can participate. Click the subscribe button so you never miss another episode. And while you're there, please leave a comment and rate the show because that helps other people find the podcast too. All right. Now grab your coffee, your notebook, and your pen as Dr. Jared Brown takes us to school. Jared, take it away.
Thank you for having me back and allowing me to talk with you and your audience about this really important, confusing, complex topic. So what I'm going to share today is going to be more through the behavioral health lens. And I should say, if you are someone that is listening because of FASD, there is very little empirical-based data about this topic in relation to FASD. I believe there's just one or two or just a few handful of studies that talk about this topic in the FASD world. Tons and tons of studies have been published on this within the context of autism and all kinds of other topics. This topic is being researched so heavily worldwide. Tons of studies come out all the time looking at it from different angles. And I want to just mention, why am I talking about this topic? Because almost every client I've worked with, almost every case I've consulted on, it seems like the person has some digestive health issues. Something's going on with the digestive health stuff. I've taken a lot of trainings kind of related directly or indirectly to the gut-brain health axis. And I actually have completed a couple different certifications related to like digestive health, coaching, things of that nature. So fascinated with this topic. And I'm convinced that as more research comes out about this on FASD, I'm pretty certain, I can't say with 100% certainty, but pretty certain that people with FASD are going to be dealing with digestive health issues frequently because of the fact we look at the autism literature, as many as 91% of people with autism have digestive health stuff going on. Very, very high percentage of people that are dealing with trauma histories, people that abuse sugar, abuse drugs, don't sleep well. We'll talk about all these things. So what are, let's maybe, Robbie, we'll think about this. What are the some of the main reasons why people go to their doctor? And if you look at the literature on why people seek primary care, the top reasons that the literature indicates is sleep disturbances, daytime fatigue, pain-related issues, and digestive health problems. all of these things go hand in hand. If you're dealing with chronic sleep deprivation, that can impact your gut. If you're dealing with chronic pain issues, all of that stress can throw off your sleep. Sometimes pain-related issues may create an environment where some people may turn to stress eating or use alcohol or drugs to cope with the pain. And if people are not sleeping, they're fatigued during the day. So when we study these topics, it's important to understand it really relates to so many different things. So the human gut, it's a complicated topic. The human gut really starts with the mouth and it ends with the anus and the esophagus and the large intestine and the small intestine and the microbiome. We'll talk about all those things today. When you study this topic, people are surprised to learn that the gut really has its own nervous system, and it's called the enteric nervous system. This has been referred to as the second brain. It's independent of the central nervous system, but it communicates with each other. So the communication kind of has a bi-directional communication pathway. So give you an example. When the central nervous system is off, the communication between the gut is often off. And what are the communication pathways? When you study this, understanding the HPA axis, the hypothalamus pituitary adrenal axis, something called the vagus nerve. So there's a lot of topics to consider, and we're not going to be able to get in the weeds with all of these, but I just want to lay the foundation if we do go into this in deeper. If the gut is off, cognition is often off, the brain is off. And if someone is dealing with like serious and persistent mental health issues, everything I've learned about this topic, that should be a pretty good indication that there's probably something also not going on properly in their gut. So think of the gut-brain axis. We'll start there. Think of it as kind of like a bi-directional neuro kind of hormonal signaling pathway between the gut and the brain. So when we're thinking of hormones, again, if the gut is off, our hormones are off. The HPA axis is off. The HPA axis is like our main hormone regulator. And when our hormones are off, that's our endocrine system. So it's so important to understand hormones when we're talking about this. There are multiple types of hormones that do different things. Understanding sleep can be off. So cortisol levels can be off. Melatonin levels can be off. There's a number of other factors. Another thing, Robbie, that people are surprised to learn when you study this topic is that the overwhelming majority of our serotonin is actually produced in our gut. Why do you want to care about serotonin? Because it's really related to mood. So if our gut is off, our mood is off often. So just really considering that. In recent years, they've really expanded the gut-brain axis to some authors really call it the microbiota gut-brain axis. So the microbiota, there's microbiota all over our body, but most of it is living. It's the microorganisms that live in the gut. And it really has a lot to do with how the gut-brain axis then communicates with the central nervous system, with the autonomic nervous system, with our neuroendocrine and neuroimmune systems. There is so much going on here. It's confusing and overwhelming. I mean, I'm learning new stuff on this all the time, but just know that usually when one aspect is off, it can have an influence on other systems, other processes, and other kind of neural communication pathways. I'll stop for a minute, Robbie. Any thoughts?
I'm staggered at how intertwined everything is. And my goodness, the importance, I guess, of understanding the gut-brain health connection, the importance of, as parents, thinking about what is it we're feeding our kids and also ourselves. You know, a lot of us are dealing with toxic stress ourselves. So our gut is off just because of the stress level. And then That affects our gut, our hormones, our brains. Of course, we're not sleeping well. I mean, I think I'm the poster child for low cortisol, worn out cortisol, and poor sleep now because of, you know, parenting intense kids for a long, long time. But too, Jared, I wanted to share with the listeners that as I've been listening to you and learning from you about the importance of gut brain health and sleep, you keep talking about that and challenging us to investigate. And so I've done that with one of my kids who is struggling the most at the moment with lethargy, with sugar seeking, with aggression, with daytime sleepiness and nighttime not wanting to sleep. And rather than seeking more and more meds, I'm going to his psychiatrist and saying, what about his gut health? What about his sleep quality? It's a bit of a puzzle to the psychiatrist, but he's open to hear. And I'm so grateful. And it was just today that we met with a sleep specialist and a pulmonologist, spoke all the same language about gut health, about his sodium levels, his iron levels, his sleeping. It was fascinating, Jared. So I'm really interested in digging into this and being able to view our kids and their challenging behaviors and symptoms through yet another lens, not just a neurobehavioral, but now also this microbiota gut axis lens.
Definitely. Thank you, Robbie, for sharing that. And always have to reiterate this. What I'm sharing today with all of you is just general education. It's not medical advice. It's just kind of what the research says. Talk to your healthcare provider about these things before making any changes in your day-to-day life. Back to the gut microbiota. So really think of that as kind of that key regulator of the gut-brain axis. So if the microbiota is off, then the gut-brain axis is off. Why should we study this topic? Why should we take the time to dig into this? Because gut microbiome, digestive health issues, all of these things really play a critical role in human diseases and health. So if your gut is off consistently, that can have negative implications for human health. If it is regulated and people have a healthy functioning gut and the gut microbiome is doing what it's supposed to and it's regulated, that can help support wellness. It can support resilience, interestingly. Also, this topic has been studied within the context of schizophrenia and bipolar disorder and depression and anxiety, and the list goes on and on and on. So if any of you are working with people with serious mental health issues, you would not go wrong from learning about this topic and seeking additional training and education and reading books on it and reading journal articles, to name a few. So if the gut is off, so that if there's alterations in the gut microbiome, and this can happen early in life and prenatally and in adulthood, it has been linked to greater dysregulation in our immune system. It's been also linked to more metabolic dysfunction. So really understanding the topic of like metabolic health is very, very important. It's been studied within the context of obesity and diabetes, asthma, and allergies. People are shocked to learn that there's plenty of studies that look at asthma and allergies within the context of disrupted digestive health functioning. It's a really fascinating connection there.
If I might right there,
yeah, go ahead.
Asthma, we know that asthma, allergies, and eczema kind of all coexist together. You know, if you have one, you're prone to have the other. You may or may not, but you're prone to. And it's interesting there, you know, what flares up eczema? Oftentimes stress, oftentimes diet.
Yes.
So it's, you know, it just makes a lot of sense. I just wanted to throw that in there.
Disruptions in the gut microbiome have also been studied within the context of irritable bowel syndrome. It's been studied within the context of Alzheimer's disease. And the list goes on and on and on. It's been studied within the context of multiple sclerosis and Parkinson's disease and various types of eating disorders. So, I mean, there's so many studies that are coming out on this. Unfortunately, few studies have come out about this within the context of FASD. I've been talking about this within the context of FASD for a good couple years now. And the reason being is I do a lot of training and consultation. I do a lot of consultation with different groups, group homes, different professionals, different caregivers. And most of the time it's working with someone with FASD, and almost always that person's gut is off in some capacity. And there's a lot of reasons for that, and I'll talk about some of that, but I'm noticing this anecdotally, just professional accounts, and then talking to caregivers from all over the country and world, I hear similar stories and things all the time. So very fascinating topic. What can impact the composition and functioning of our gut microbiota? Our lifestyle. What kind of lifestyle do we lead? Are we haggard all the time and we're just running and go, 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 and we never slow down? Are we living in a crowded environment? There's actually at least one study I'm aware of that looked at how living in a very crowded environment can throw off the gut. Obviously, it's probably linked to stress because lots of commotion, noise, people aren't sleeping well. Diet plays a critical role in this. Eating healthy can help support it. Eating unhealthy, obviously, can disrupt it. Certain kinds of medications have been shown to disrupt the gut. Our social networks have been linked to gut composition. So if we're in collaboration with very healthy, loving, stable people, you can about imagine our guts are probably going to function better because we're under less stress. We feel more connected. If we're around people that are just very stressful and negative and abusive, that can have a profound impact. Now, Robbie, I said there's not much research on FASD and gut microbiome and digestive health issues, but there's a lot of studies that have looked at prenatal health and early postnatal factors and looking at all kinds of different things going on. So what was the composition of the microbiota of the mother while pregnant? Was she going through a lot of stress? Was she using drugs, alcohol? Was she not taking care of herself? Was she on all kinds of different medications? Was she dealing with a lot of infections or obesity, or the list goes on? So there's a couple studies I'm aware of where they've looked at what kind of maternal factors may negatively impact an infant's gut microbiota. If mom smoked during pregnancy or early on in life, that has been studied within this context. They've actually looked at this within the context, did mom live in a rural environment versus an urban environment? So I think they were getting at that study. If she lived in an urban environment, was she exposed to lots of stress, crowded living conditions? Was she in an environment where there was a lot of chaos going on? And by no means am I saying you live in an urban environment, that's going to happen, but just considering the environment someone lives in. Socioeconomic status has been studied within this context. So they found in some of these studies that lower socioeconomic status contributed to more disruptions in the infant's gut microbiota. Because obviously, if someone is living in poverty, what can happen? More stress, more worry, more exposure to environmental toxins, community violence exposure. Was there food insecurity and they were skipping meals all the time or relying on gas station food all the time or going to food shelves? And again, nothing against food shelves, but at least in my experience, a lot of the food at food shelves are often energy dense processed foods loaded with sugars and sodiums and carbs. And again, just take that with a grain of salt. Malnutrition has been studied within this context as well. And looking at just different kinds of health inequities. So marginalization, oppression, those kind of things, racism. Just looking at political kinds of factors, economic factors, and social factors, to name a few. Fascinatingly, too, this research has looked at other factors that might impact gut microbiota in young children. And some of the studies have looked at the difference between a vaginal birth and a cesarean birth. So they've studied the differences between those. They have also looked at circadian rhythms, fascinating, or sleep-wake cycles. So if people have really disrupted sleep patterns, maybe they work shift work. Maybe they've had trauma and they're afraid of the dark. Maybe they deal with jet lag. So someone, maybe a few days is staying up all night. The next day they have a good sleep pattern. The next day they're up all night. Just that up and down kind of swing of their sleep cycle. That's a factor. Daylight savings times too. We just had daylight savings time and I feel off. I still feel off and it was only an hour. So just this factors, anything that kind of throws off our rhythm in our body can have a major factor as well. So Robbie, I'll stop there for a minute and then I'll talk a little bit about inflammation, oxidative stress, and telomeres too, and how that factors into this.
Appreciate that. You mentioned daylight savings time and feeling off. You know, I have to say it doesn't really affect me, but my kids yesterday were absolutely wrecked, you know, just wrecked by 1 hour difference. And we fortunately are able to maintain a good sleep routine in our home and kids are to bed early and up at a regular time. That speaks to their inherent sensitivities because of the prenatal alcohol exposure. I think sometimes those of us who are lay people in the field or even professionals in the field negate how extraordinarily impactful prenatal alcohol exposure is on that developing body. And just reminds me of how sensitive our kids are to any sort of disruption. And if they're prenatally exposed to alcohol, there's likely other things happening. There's likely nicotine. There's likely a great deal of stress and maternal unwell-being in the, not always, but generally. And so that child is so vulnerable in that prenatal period. And then the rest of life builds upon this vulnerable system, this vulnerable brain and body. And so our kids are extraordinarily sensitive. And I was recently in touch with some folks that are doing a study and about prenatal alcohol exposure and gut health and brain health. And it was fascinating what they were sharing with me. And that will be coming up in a future episode.
Oh, cool. Okay. Wonderful. I'm glad to hear that for sure. When we talk about this topic too, I would recommend learning about dysbiosis. So dysbiosis is just another term of saying that the gut is off, gut permeability. There's just something going on in the gut that's off. And I mentioned just before inflammation, oxidative stress, telomeres. All of these have been studied too within the context of gut dysbiosis. So let's take inflammation, for example. Inflammation is not a bad thing. We need it to heal. But what happens if someone is dealing with inflammation that's activated over and over and over again over a long period of time? So chronic low-grade inflammation, which has been shown to be higher among people that have had extensive child abuse histories as well. So we're dealing with chronic low-grade inflammation, which then could contribute to oxidative stress. And if we're dealing with oxidative stress, that can do damage to our bodies. And then in some cases, this can contribute to more wear and tear in our bodies, which is basically allostatic load. And something called telomeres, which is kind of a biological marker for other types of wear and tear in our body, where it's the end caps in our brain and our chromosomes. And all of these things have been shown to be exacerbated by gut dysbiosis. They all kind of work hand in hand. So these are just things you want to consider. Early life factors have been shown to contribute to greater inflammation and telomere shortenings. These are all kind of things at the biological level that people probably haven't had a lot of training on. And another topic when we're talking about all these topics is mitochondrial functioning and mitochondrial health and mitochondrial dysfunction. That's basically our cellular energy. So that is a fascinating topic. It's been studied within the context of so many different disorders as well. So we talked about what can throw off the gut. What are risk factors for dysbiosis? extensive uses of antibiotics have been studied within this context to contribute to more dysbiosis, obesity, having high fat diets and high sugar diets, exposure to heavy metals and pesticides. So being aware of endocrine disruptors as well, and social stressors, to name a few. So if we're dealing with dysbiosis, or we're having just gut microbiota alterations, what can happen? We may have more food cravings. It could throw off our metabolism. We could be more reactive to stress. It can absolutely impact our mood, and it can compromise our immune system functioning and our overall health. So just to recap kind of where we're at, a couple things we want to think about that can throw off the gut again. Stressors, circadian rhythms, even our feeding patterns, skipping meals, eating too much, not eating enough, having dysregulated blood sugar levels, physical inactivity, exercising too much. These are all things that can really have an impact. Psychological stress can throw off the gut. We know that chronic stress over the long haul can contribute to blood pressure issues, blood sugar imbalances, food cravings, sluggish digestion, sleep issues, to name a few. Prenatal stress, again, we need to be aware of any kind of stress mom was dealing with during pregnancy. So prenatal stress. Some of the adverse childhood experiences literature has talked about how extensive childhood traumas can absolutely impact biological health, neurological health, the gut. It can contribute to chronic disease over the lifespan. And the ACEs research, the adverse childhood experiences literature, has also talked about extensive childhood traumas that have gone unaddressed may be a factor for increases in obesity, food addiction, elevated cortisol levels, more pro-inflammatory kinds of mechanisms in the body. There's something called pro-inflammatory cytokines and a number of other things we don't have to talk about today, but there's a lot going on at kind of that biological endocrine gut immune system functioning level. So just be aware that when we're dealing with tons of stress, trauma, adversity, hardship, burnout, these are all things that could trigger kind of a low-grade inflammatory kind of response in our body. There's a lot of other things that can contribute to this as well in terms of low-grade chronic inflammation. Chronic infections, infections that go untreated. Our diet, and we know our diet can throw off the gut, but diet can throw off inflammation and it can exacerbate inflammation. Air pollution exposure has been shown in some cases to contribute to more chronic inflammation. So let's say someone lives very close to a factory or a busy freeway. They're exposed to environmental toxins, as I mentioned before. Maybe someone works in a factory and they're around a lot of hazardous materials or industrial chemicals, or they smoke cigarettes. These are all things that can not only throw off the gut, but contribute to more inflammation. Confinement. I know there's at least one study that shows the very nature of being confined within a prison setting can throw off the gut. It can contribute to poor health outcomes. So we need to be aware too, if any of you are ever working with criminal justice involved populations. Earlier this year, I know there was one study that was published that looked at prenatal alcohol exposure and gut microbiota. I believe the title of the article was Evidence for Long-Lasting Alterations in Fecal Microbiota Following Prenatal Alcohol Exposure. It was published in the Journal of Alcoholism, Clinical and Experimental Research. So that would be a fantastic article to look at. Some studies have looked at this within the context of ADHD as well. We know ADHD is probably the number one co-occurring disorder you're going to find among people with FASD. Autism, as I mentioned, tons and tons of studies on autism. And even traumatic brain injury. There are several studies that have looked at traumatic brain injury induced gut microbiota dysbiosis. Why might that be the case? Because you have the initial head injury. Let's say someone gets hit in the head. You have the primary damage, but then you have the secondary issues that can happen after the brain injury that can really happen minutes, hours, or days after that, where the brain is not functioning correctly. Neural hormones are off. All of these neurotoxins flood the body. It can throw off the gut. It can throw off the communication with the body. It's fascinating and scary research at the same time. When you study this topic too, I would recommend learning about sickness behavior. That's another term to be aware of. It's probably more common in the medical literature, but sickness behavior really manifests itself as fatigue and withdrawal behavior and depression and a number of other kinds of symptoms. It's called sickness behavior. The Western diet has been studied within the context of contributing to modifications to the gut microbiota. The Western diet is just going to be diets that are heavily processed foods, fast foods, sugar sweetened beverages, things loaded with sugars and salts and lots of just, I hate to say it, things that are not good for the human body. You and I think, Robbie, we've done two talks now on sugar, if I remember right.
Yeah.
And there's a couple, good handful of studies that have talked about excessive sugar consumption can absolutely throw off the gut and it can contribute to more inflammation. A couple studies have also talked about high fructose corn syrup. So people have a diet very high in high fructose corn syrup. That may be a factor that can negatively impact the gut. Couple studies have also looked at it within the context of aspartame. So just being aware of aspartame and if you're drinking a lot of diet sodas, those kind of things. Couple studies have looked at this just within the context of relying on a fast food diet. So people eat fast foods. That has been shown to possibly increase depression and gut dysbiosis as well. So the list goes on. Robbie, any thoughts that you have right now? I can move into just a few kind of just basic intervention strategies if that's helpful.
Yeah, I think so. Let's slide over to what can we do?
Know about these things first and foremost, I think. I know the series we're doing is really learning about threats to emotional health, which learning about the other things we're talking about in this series. We talked about alexithymia at one point. That is an emotional processing, emotional awareness deficit. And there are a good handful of studies that have shown that people that have alexithymia who really struggle with naming, processing, labeling their emotions may be more likely to have unhealthy dietary patterns because of stress-related eating, which makes a lot of sense. Let's say someone has alexithymia, doesn't know what's going on, and they have a hard time dealing with stress, trauma, adversity. All of that stress goes in their body, which then creates physiological dysregulation. What can help someone feel better in the short term?
Ice cream, Jared, yes. Ice cream.
Yes.
Haagen-Dazs.
Absolutely. Fast food, drinking soda, all the things that taste good.
Yeah.
And probably help you feel good for a very short period of time. Once that wears off and your blood sugar levels kind of get back under control because now they're out of whack, you want more and you want more and more and more and more.
So what goes together with that, right? Like screen time and snacky foods like chips or some people really seek candy, but chips and popcorn and ice cream and soda, all that goes together, pizza and what about beer and the wine and the alcohol and the cigarettes that people turn to when they're stressed?
Spot on. Couldn't say any better myself. I'm a big fan of learning about lifestyle literature. Just typing in the word lifestyle into Google Scholar, you'll find so many studies. What are the lifestyle factors that can positively influence mental health? Financial stability has been shown to be helpful. if you're dealing with a lot of stress around money, easier said than done. I know at least in the United States, we're dealing with very high inflation. And I hear from lots of people, it's causing a lot of stress, worry, and hardship. Time in nature is a lifestyle factor that's been linked to better mental health. So if someone is always inside their house, or they live in an area where they do not have access to parks, woods, even blue space, rivers, lakes, oceans, something like that, that can have an impact on health. So being in nature, pet ownership has been shown to be a positive factor in mental health. Reducing materialism is a factor that comes up in this literature. So people are always striving for the next dollar, want to buy the next best thing, the best car. That actually can impact mental health. So if we can help people reduce materialism, that's been shown to be a good thing. Reducing social media and smart time and screen time exposure is absolutely discussed in the lifestyle literature. I talk a lot when I give trainings, Robbie, on the topic of biopsychosocial kinds of factors. There's interventions that can target biopsychosocial factors. So biological could be nutrition, psychological, it could be cognitive training or metacognition training or executive functioning training. Social, getting connected to positive, healthy groups, volunteering, those kind of things. That's basically interventions that target biopsychosocial factors. In this literature too, there's something called therapeutic lifestyle changes. I'm a big fan of that research as well. Therapeutic lifestyle changes are very similar to what I just spoke about before, but it's really helping people look at lifestyle factors that may be contributing to poor health and fostering individual and social well-being while helping to enhance and optimize cognitive and behavioral performance. And part of lifestyle therapeutic interventions is really going to focus on nutrition and weight management, getting sleep under control, exercise, but also learning self-regulation. We've talked about that a lot. If you have better self-regulation, you're typically happier and healthier, to name a few. So that's kind of a huge, huge topic in a nutshell. But hopefully we planted the seeds and we can take this to the next level. But the gut microbiome access is fascinating, complex, and a lot of moving parts. And it really can influence all facets of the human body. And it's been linked to so many different diseases, illnesses, and disorders.
Thank you so much for getting us to think about these topics. And I think many people who might be like me might be thinking, I'm too late to this party. I mean, I don't know anything about nutrition. I don't know what I'm doing. I think we, even if we just start with the baby steps, as you said, Jared, about coming to know some of this, these things, and some, you know, some very basic lifestyle choices can be, I think we talked about this last time, was, you know, have a glass of water instead of a glass of juice, or a glass of water instead of a pop. It's a simple baby step, but it can, you know, even little steps can change the trajectory. When I'm speaking to moms now, the moms, the dads who are listening, when we're thinking about, okay, what are the meals going to be for the week? And you're like, Robbie, I don't even have time to think about that. I've been there, and that's part of the problem, is when we don't have a plan, then we go for fast food, or we go for the frozen pizza, and guilty, they're in my freezer too. You know, we go for the processed stuff because it's quick and because we have a lot going on. But if we can catch our breath, take a step back and do some menu planning, then that's another lifestyle change that we can implement. And, you know, and if that means, like, if you are living on fast food and takeaways all the time, you know, you're not going to change that all right now. But what if you did one day a week where you're cooking at home? And what if you made a double portion of that meal so that you could put half of it in the freezer for next week? You know, little lifestyle changes, I think, is where we have to start. I'm really fascinated by this, Jared, but I have a question too. I've been speaking recently with adults, young adults who have FASD, and they are struggling so much with kind of a cusp of, like, depression, not feeling like they fit in anywhere, not having a lot of social agency. And they too need to become aware of some of these therapeutic lifestyle choices. How do we guide our young adults, Jared? And think about it from your clinical population that you have worked with for so many years. This is a very challenging demographic to work with. How might we support them in or teach them to help themselves, really, I suppose?
Getting that multidisciplinary group together, getting caregivers, family members together and getting trained in this too. And probably, in my opinion, using executive functioning based approaches, using metacognition based approaches, thinking about thinking, knowing about knowing. There's a couple studies that show using metacognition training can be very helpful for people with FASD. And there's actually been a good handful of studies that talk about using metacognition training to improve health literacy and nutrition literacy in general populations too. So if people have better nutritional literacy and health literacy, they're more likely to read a food label and understand it and make more informed decisions. They're more likely to seek advice from their healthcare professionals. I think those are things to consider. For an FASD brain too, we want to probably use approaches that are coaching, modeling, teaching, role-playing, scaffolding-based interventions, taking into account their working memory and the way they process information and learn it and retain it. So just taking into account their developmental age, their social age, and their cognitive age as well.
And whether or not they do have social supports or formal supports around them, you know, what is there? It's complicated and it's a difficult thing. And I'm just thinking, I mean, we've been talking about the gut health and the brain health. And that's a deep subject to go into, but I think it's, so many of our people who have FASD in their adolescence and their young adulthood, they're really struggling and they're struggling with so many different things. And a lot of that is their sense of well-being, their sense of whether they're depressed or suicidal or their place in the world too. And it seems maybe trivial to focus on the gut, but I think maybe that's exactly what we need to be doing. And when we think about metacognition, thinking about thinking, Jared, is that where we start to think about like challenging people to, well, let's just look at how much sugar you might take in a day and what is the recommendation? And we talk and we coach and we model. And even there, if we can get our people to be reading labels, that's the beginning of some literacy, isn't it?
And I think so. Yeah, but doing that with a qualified nutritionist is important, or a functional medicine specialist, and getting advice from those individuals, I think is very helpful.
Personally, medical specialist, that's a tricky term because I live in Canada and I'm not sure where to go to find that. When I was speaking with our physician, when I was querying, asking for some, you know, testing to check gut biome, she says, we don't really do that. I asked the psychiatrist, he goes, I don't really know where to send you. So I don't know exactly where to go. I think I might have to go to the naturopath route.
Yeah, depending, like in the United States, I suppose, depending on what state, I mean, it could be a naturopathic doctor. It could be a functional medicine specialist or a functional nutritionist. Maybe it's a nutritional coach. It's tough to know. And do all these people take insurance? Are they self-pay? In my experience, a lot of these professionals might be more self-pay, but that can differ, I think, from state to state and country to country too.
Right. So again, there's challenges to, yes, getting these tests done and to understand or even to be able to afford the therapeutics. There are definitely challenges there.
If I could say, you brought up some good points. I mean, what can we do to make this better? Get sleep under control. That is a huge factor. Talk to a sleep doctor. You mentioned stay hydrated or drink water. Talk, yep, to a nutritionist.
Yep.
Manage stress.
Yeah.
Talk to a dentist. Dental health is linked to gut health and heart health. All of these things, they're so interconnected. So there's a lot of things we can do. There's no doubt about it.
There's a lot of things we can do. Wow. How about that, you all? We need to make more appointments, or maybe not. We need to sit back and reflect on where are we and what's the next right step. Please don't feel like, oh my gosh, I've gotten it all wrong, or I have a million things to do. Please don't do that to yourself. You're doing the best you can with the information you have. Take some time to listen and reflect about what's my next right step. When's the last time my child has been to the dentist? When's the last time they've had a blood panel done? Let's see where their, you know, where their iron levels are, where their sugar levels are. Let's just get a fulsome checkup here and a dental checkup, and then speak with the, you know, share this with the psychiatrist that you're working with, and just the one next step. You can't do everything all at once. Please be gracious with yourself. I don't want you to feel overwhelmed. And I know Dr. Brown doesn't want you to feel overwhelmed with this information either.
Definitely not. It's a lot. And Robbie, if we were to take this to the next level, I would recommend we do something on psychoneuroendocrine immunology. It's a fascinating field of study. Mind, gut, brain, inflammation, immune system, and how it all plays out. I kind of sprinkled in a few things about that. I've been giving more talks on that topic. It's mind-blowing after people hear it. I hear the same feedback every time. Why am I only learning about this now?
Yeah.
How do we get this into every training program and school program for counselors, therapists, cops? It's a life-changing view of how we look at disease and illness and disorders.
All right, everybody, you heard that here. We're going to cover that next time with Dr. Jared Brown, because, you know, when, like I always say, when we know better, we can do better.
Yes.
So thank you, Dr. Brown, for being with us today. I so appreciate it. I took pages and pages of notes, and I'm going to go back and listen, and I'm sure I'll take more notes. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
Wasn't that fascinating? And thank you again, Jared, for giving us your time and your expertise to skill us up as parents advocating and caring for our kids who have been prenatally exposed to alcohol. I had no idea that gut health played such a critical role in overall health, wellness, mental health, and resilience. I had no idea. So I was so glad when he shared all this information with me, and I'm going to go back over this episode and listen to it again, because there's so much to mine out of this episode with Dr. Brown. As I mentioned at the top of the show, be sure to join me for the next episode of the podcast, when I'll tell you about a fascinating research study that's looking into this very thing, the impact of prenatal alcohol exposure on microbiota and gut health, and how you can participate in the study. So subscribe now, and every new episode will be dropped right into your email inbox, so you never miss another episode. Do you want more? Register for my live online FASD parent training courses. I've got FASD Brain Domains and Parenting to the Brain. These courses will take you on a deep dive into FASD and give you the practical skills you need to transform your family life from the very first class. I created these courses with my partner, Mary Ellen McPhail. She is the executive director of O'Shea's Brain Domain in Scotland and parent of three with FASD. The Brain Domain course is a 5-week course, and Parenting to the Brain is a 6-week course. And there's a link in the show notes where you can register. Looking for a masterclass? Check out Patty Casper's masterclass, What's Driving Your Child's Pesky Behavior, on November 29th. And there's a link in the show notes for you. Are you looking to deepen your understanding of FASD and build a community of support with parents who understand? Join our community of support. The FASD Family Life Community Support Group meets the third Tuesday of every month at 6 p.m. Mountain Standard Time. You can subscribe today for only $10 a month, and there is a link in the show notes. Thank you for spending your time with me. I know it's precious. Until next time, remember, the struggle is real, and so is success. I'll speak with you soon.